The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Dave Lindorf. Dave is an award-winning investigative reporter, journalist. He contributes regularly to numerous publications and popular websites in America, abroad. He's also a prolific author. A couple of his books are The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing George W. Bush. That's a very timely book, Dave, because there was just a simulated trial, I guess is the way to describe it, in Malaysia, and there wasn't any doubt that he'd be convicted. But let me mention a couple more of your books. He was convicted, he and Tony Blair. Well, a lot more than the two of them need to be convicted, but that's a good start. Dave also wrote This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, and Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains. He's got other books as well. Dave, I welcome you to the program.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's terrific having you on. We can go almost any direction at all. I noticed.
Let me just mention, and maybe this will kick us off in one direction, that the fourth book that I wrote was Killing Time, about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, which just had its 30th anniversary of his arrest and jailing on Friday. And there's been a dramatic development in that case, which was that the Supreme Court in October finally and decisively ended his death penalty by refusing to consider an appeal of a Third Circuit ruling that had confirmed the lifting of his death penalty. And the district attorney of Philadelphia on Wednesday, as I had predicted, announced that he was not going to seek a retrial on the penalty to try to reestablish the death penalty. So, as of that announcement, Jamal is no longer facing death, period. Death is off the table, but it reverts to life in prison without parole, which is a pretty ugly alternative.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I have your website on my desktop, thiscan'tbehappening.net, and I've got your newest article, which is about what you're talking about. And I read your book, Dave. It's been a good while now. The book has been out a while, and
yes,
I read your book,
three.
And it made a big impact on me. And that was long before I started writing myself. And having done it, I realize how many people are wrongfully convicted and imprisoned and sentenced to death and so on. I mean, it's a horrible system. In my state, Illinois, you know it, Dave, that a former governor, Governor Ryan, commuted death row inmates because he discovered that a lot of them, there is an innocence project in Chicago, and they were discovering a good number of convicted death row inmates that, in fact, were innocent. And a number were released because of the Innocence Project. And then George Ryan decided that the whole system is unworkable, and he just cleared death row. And that ought to happen all over the country. But talk some more about Tim Mumia. That's a big issue. He's probably the most famous political prisoner. But he's been in prison for 30 years, Dave.
Yeah, the latest aspect of that is really emblematic of peculiar American fetish or obsession with state killing, because you had the police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, nationally and in Pennsylvania, actively lobbying for his execution, which, you know, really raises questions. Police are supposed to be sworn to uphold the Constitution, and it's unseemly, it seems to me, for peace officers to be, you know, actually financing the election of judges who are going to decide these cases, and did, you know, in many of his appeals. You know, buying judges in order to get them, you know, making the issue be, are you going to, you know, vote for death for Jamal? And these judges right up to the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania never recused themselves for being, even for being former members of the Fraternal Order of Police, some of them, and for taking that tainted money. But in any rate, the thing about Jamal is that the vindictiveness and the desire to kill him was so intense that when a federal judge in 2001 ruled that his sentencing hearing had been unconstitutional because of a biased instruction from the judge that leaned towards convincing the jurors to sentence him to death instead of life without parole, even though the federal judge had ruled that, the district attorney at the time, Lynn Abraham, who was called by the New York Times America's deadliest DA because of the number of people she'd sent to death row in Pennsylvania, she asked to have him kept on death row during their appeal of that ruling. That appeal lasted until this last October, 10 years. So for 10 years that he has not been technically facing death, but has been having that ruling appealed, he has been in solitary confinement on this horrible, you know, supermax death row that Pennsylvania has, where his room is the size of a small apartment bathroom. It has no windows. He has been unable for 29 years to even touch another human being physically, including his own grandchildren, because they have this rule that the only way you can have a visitor there is through bulletproof plexiglass on an electronic communication, and even then you're brought in shackled, you know, ridiculously, it's just an obscenity. You're brought in shackled to sit in this other side of the room, you know, through this plexiglass. The whole thing is just unbelievably, it's torture, first of all, under international law. Bishop Desmond Tutu went to visit him once and refused to see him if they didn't take off the shackles. And, you know, because of his poet laureate status, they took them off that one time, but he still was behind the plexiglass. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And so, you know, they kept him there for 10 years beyond his successful appeal of the sentence. And so we were arguing, I certainly argued in my article a month and a half ago, that after a 30-year sentence that was ruled unconstitutional, to just then say, oh, okay, well, we'll revert to what he would have had, which is life without parole, is really obscene. I mean, barbaric. He already spent 30 years unconstitutionally in this hell. So really, they ought to just release him. For time served,
they should release him. Absolutely. I remember I read a few of his books, Dave, and I remember in one of them he said that the authorities would rather give him an Uzi than a microphone, because he's a powerful voice, and they don't want that voice released to the public. Just imagine if he ever were released, the effect that would have, and the resonance, even greater resonance of what he has to say. It really would be powerful, and I'm certain there's no way they want to let him out of prison.
No, and in fact, I think that the reason they did not, they claimed at the press conference, which included the widow of the slain officer who has been on a very sad, you know, obsessive march for all those years to try to have him killed. They both said the reason they decided not to take the opportunity they have to seek a new trial on the penalty was because they didn't want to. She said she didn't want to waste, you know, Philadelphia's money when it's having a hard time, and she didn't want also to give him another forum for, you know, publicity about his case. And that was Williams, the DA Williams, claim too, that he didn't want to give him any more publicity and, you know, just let him sit in jail where he belonged for the till he dies. It was pretty ugly stuff, but I don't believe a word of it. I think the reason that they did not seek a new death penalty, besides the fact that they probably would lose the effort because, you know, times have changed in Philadelphia and you can't keep blacks off the jury, but also, even if they could, by maybe, for example, getting the trial moved to, you know, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or some other, you know, racist part of the state, the real problem is if they held that hearing, the defense would have the opportunity to call in the original trial witnesses who had depicted the shooting as a cold-blooded execution. All those witnesses lied. I documented that in my book. They were all perjurers, probably put up to it by the cops and the prosecutor. And it, with good lawyering now and more witnesses that have been uncovered, they'd be able to prove that those witnesses lied, not just about how the execution looked, but what actually happened. And it would have opened the door to a new trial on the underlying conviction. And that's why Williams didn't dare to call that hearing. This way he gets to bury the case, you know, factually. It's very hard to get a new trial now at this point unless they can come up with an absolutely new witness that they couldn't have found before. And so, you know, he's in a tough spot with the life imprisonment, but that's why they didn't do it, because he could have gotten a new trial possibly out of a hearing on the death penalty.
And it looks pretty much, Dave, that there really isn't very much doubt that Mumia is an innocent man, and of course he's a world figure, and whether he's in prison or whether he would have a more open stage to discuss his case and the injustice against him, I think there are so many millions of people around the world that know that he was unjustly convicted. Again, it's been a while since I've read your book, but the trial judge, Sabo, was that his name?
Sabo,
a racist judge, and the abuses just continued after that. And here, a powerful voice is put away behind bars forever. And the scheme had to be, Dave, that they simply wanted to silence him, and they found a way to do it. I know he was a radio host. He had a lot of on air time, and he's a very eloquent guy, so his views can be powerfully stated, and they absolutely don't want those views on public airways. So people can hear them, and now more than ever, because back then nobody—he was a nobody back then. People in Philadelphia knew him, but people outside did not. But now he's a world figure, so he really is a bigger than life individual.
Yeah, and then I guess the good thing about where he moves into the general prison population is he'll have much more access to the public, both to people visiting with him and him getting his word out. You know, he no longer will have these really outrageous restrictions on him that they have in that Supermax prison. He'll get to hold his grandchildren finally.
Oh, well, that would be wonderful. How in under the conditions in death row, how did he ever write books? How did he ever do programs like prison radio? How did he manage to do that?
It's a tribute to his incredible willpower. I mean, and intelligence. He's gotten 2 degrees while he's there. He has no access to a computer. Everything he writes has to be by hand, and entire books. He has no access to, you know, cable TV as like minimum channels that I think he gets to watch on television. He has one day a week he gets a 15-minute phone call, which is, of course, monitored, and interrupted every minute with a recording saying you have, you know, telling how much more time is left.
Well, I've heard that.
Yeah, and And, of course, he doesn't get to see hardly anybody. I mean, his visiting list is very short, and the time that people can see him is very short. And it's all monitored on because it's done electronically. You talk through the a phone wire, you know it's all being monitored. So, it's just unbelievable that he's been able to accomplish the amount that he's accomplished, to stay aware of what's going on in the world to the extent that he has, which is also amazing. Just an amazing guy. And he's going to have a lot more access to the outside world now. So, you know, I would say watch out. You know, the guy's going to be much more out in their face now.
Well, you're right, Dave. He's amazing. I mean, I've read his books. I've read some of his articles. I've heard, it's been a long time, but I've heard the prison radio brief reports that he's given. My goodness, how can a guy do this stuff and no computer, no real information that you and I get every single day, and yet he seems to know what's going on in the world, and he speaks so eloquently about it. I mean, it really is astonishing. I can't imagine how he's done it. I simply can't imagine it.
Well, one of the things it speaks to is his innocence, because, you know, if he really had done the deed, you would find it very hard to imagine he wouldn't have sunk into a deep depression at this point. But his, you know, I think his internal will to escape and prove his innocence and battle back against this injustice has probably been the main thing that's kept him going.
Well, I think that's right.
That kept his sanity, you know.
Oh, kept his sanity, and it's been a while since I heard him last or read anything by him, but talk about a level-headed person discussing the right issues, presenting the right point of view. I mean, he is right on it. He can match people like you or me, Dave, with easy access to any information we want to get, and here he's locked in, is he out of death row now?
No, he's still there, but I think it'll be a pretty short. I think there's a formalistic hearing that has to be held, which has yet to be scheduled, which will actually formally convert his sentence from death to life imprisonment. In other words, the death penalty is gone. He hasn't formally been resentenced to life in prison, which is the default in this case. So when that hearing is held, which will be in a common pleas courtroom in Philadelphia, at that point it would be illegal for them to hold him on death row. And up to, you know, what they ought to do, you know, the DA, as a matter of basic humanitarian decency, should be to ask to have him moved right now. But of course he won't do that because he's a swine and captive to the Fraternal Order of Police politics in this town, but that's what should happen. I'm sure his lawyers will be, if they haven't already, petitioning to have him moved immediately, but who knows what the courts will do, because they're also in hock to, you know, the FOP. So I think they're going to keep him just out of pure vindictiveness on death row in that cell as long as they can. But that hearing will be the day that he moves.
Well, I agree with you. Why let him out if you don't have to? You schedule a hearing. You can delay it as long as you want, and then
yeah, it could
some
be
point,
months. It could still be months.
Oh, it could be a long time, and vindictiveness is right, Dave. So many issues. What else have you been writing about lately? I mean, there's so much going on domestically and abroad. It obsesses me, and there's a whole menu of possible things to write on. I jump on a topic every single day. And
we at This Can't Be Happening have been doing a lot of focus on the Occupy movement, and I encourage people to come look at our coverage, because I think we have some unique perspectives on it. One is my colleague Chuck Young. He writes under Charles M. Young, former Rolling Stone political writer who took over from Hunter Thompson's role for years. Chuck went down and was at the occupation in Manhattan where he lives at the Zuccotti Place almost from day one, and was there when they rousted them the first time, and had the big pepper spraying incident. He was down there when they rousted them once and for all. And he's written some astonishing pieces that give you a real inside flavor of what the occupation is all about and how, who these people are. We've got a woman who's joined our collective, Laurie Spencer from Austin, who has been visiting spending a lot of time at Occupy Oklahoma City, and has also been visiting other sites around Texas, you know, Dallas, Austin, Houston, and other Occupy sites. She's doing really great work covering the Midwest occupiers, or at least the southern part of the Midwest, not up your way. Lynn Washington's been covering the occupation in London, where, you know, there are people occupying outside St. Paul's Cathedral in London after being rousted from their site in the city. And he's been over in Paris, too. So I think we've got, you know, I went down to Washington the day that started and made some comparisons between Washington and Philly and New York. And we've just been on top of it. And I think what I've been looking at lately is the issue of the very apparent national coordination of the crackdown on these occupiers, which I think is a real serious thing, because it manifests how we have created a national police force, the Gestapo.
Well, that's very true, Dave, and Occupy Wall Street is a very big issue for me, including what's going on in Europe. I haven't followed it there as much as I have here, but my new book, you're way ahead of me on books. I've got two, and my new one that came out in September is called How Wall Street Fleeces America. It could have come out in June. It was ready to be published, but my editor said, September is when the trade does the most buying, so we held it off until then. Well, it was very fortuitous, obviously, and it's marvelous that we did it that way. And she asked me to do a follow-up book concentrating on Occupy Wall Street and the Eurozone crisis. So I'm working on that, and they go hand in hand. And I'm a little concerned about what's going on and how the focus is, and the lack of leadership and a number of issues. But I'm so impressed with the determination of people just to keep going despite the police violence against them. All of the stuff that's going on, and there's no question in my mind that there's a coordinated national effort. You've got your local police departments, but they're militarized, they're getting weapons, they're getting funding from Washington. And I expect the crackdowns to get meaner, Dave, if the movement really gains even more traction, and I think it will. And it could be that the cops are going to, as bad as they've been so far, what is it, one death from around the country?
Yeah, I don't think there's been a death that can be laid at the door of the cops yet, but it's been close.
Close.
You know, that guy, the Marine that was hit with the tear gas canister fired almost point blank at him, was, you know, had he died, I think there could have been at least a wrongful death suit, one in that, and maybe worse against the cops.
Oh, absolutely. Scott Olson, out in Oakland.
Truly obscene. You know, these things are really projectiles fired out of small cannons in the hands of the cops, and to point it at somebody is to really risk death.
Well, I've written about how Israel uses the same technique, and they fire them directly at Palestinians, and they cause a good number of injuries, and once in a while they kill somebody.
There was an American woman there who was hit by one and lost an eye. And nearly died herself in one. She was supporting the Palestinians in some demonstration, and they fired and hit her right in the face.
And
she was lucky to live through that.
Oh, absolutely.
Lost her eye.
Absolutely. In some cases.
And the tragedy in her case was she's an artist. So, I mean, losing an eye is a doubly serious offense.
Boy, it sure is. I'm familiar with some cases where Israeli forces were very close to the people they were targeting. I mean, so close, and then you fire at somebody's head, and I mean, you can kill somebody, and there are deaths that happen, and
yep.
The same thing could happen here. And both, I mean, Israeli forces, U.S. police, military can be brought out on the street here if they want to. And we've got this oppressive law going through the Congress right now.
Oh, my God.
You want to talk about that for a minute?
Military. No, it's all of a piece, Steve. It's just amazing. I mean, they really are, here we have Obama. It was supposed to be the constitutional scholar who was saying in his campaign that we were going to have a return to respect for the Constitution. And he's taking it. Another quantum leap beyond what Bush was doing. You know, first we had the killing of an American citizen, two American citizens, by order of the president with no trial, because in one case, Al-Awlaki, the guy has never been accused of doing anything. It's just what he's been saying, which is critical of America and calling for, you know, resistance to America. And for that, he born in America, he was executed on orders of the president. That's phenomenal. And now, of course, as you alluded to, the Senate, by 93-7, voted to authorize the not only arrest and imprisonment and holding indefinitely without trial of American citizens, but to have that done by military people inside the United States. I mean, that's why we had a revolution back in the 18th century, was because the British troops were doing that, and it's enshrined in our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that you can't do that, you know. And yet, I mean, it violates the Fourth and the Eighth and the Sixth Amendments. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Most people don't remember. I do because I wrote about it at the time. But and I have trouble remembering dates. I've mentioned this on the program before. There's one date that I remember very well. Two laws passed on that date. It was October 17th, 2006. On that date, the Military Commissions Act passed. Technically, it was for non-U.S. Citizens, but U.S. citizens could be affected as well. I don't know
right.
that any have, but they could have been under this law where the military could grab somebody, put them in a military prison, either leave them there, torture them, put them on trial, don't put them on trial. We now have indefinite detentions of U.S. citizens or anybody. That was Obama. We have the assassinations of U.S. citizens abroad. The next step is do it right here on the homeland. And now we have these two provisions in the Senate bill. I'm not certain if it's one or more provisions in the House bill, but both houses passed these provisions inserted in the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. That's the
yep.
way they always do it, Dave. They
yeah,
want to
link
get something
it into
hideous.
Something that's well. Also, don't forget this is it actually includes an authorization for use of military force that extends the 2001 authorization that brought us the Patriot Act and the invasion of Afghanistan. It officially turns the United States into a war zone in the war on terror, which never ends. So then they're arguing they can use wartime commissions and wartime logic within the borders of the United States. It's absolutely absurd, and a decent Supreme Court would throw it out in a minute. But we don't have a decent Supreme Court. But you know, you made a point. You don't know if they have arrested any Americans under the 2006 Act, and the reason you don't know is because part of that act was that the president didn't have to tell anybody, or the military didn't have to tell anybody if they were arrested under that. So that's the other part. You know, it's secret. So an American can be snatched up and disappeared legally under that act. and probably has been. I have very little doubt that they've used what they're able to use.
Oh, well, they certainly will use it, and if they haven't, they will use it. It's hideous stuff. Dave, let's take a break and come back. I wanted to mention the other law that passed on October 17, 2006. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back. On with Dave Lindoff, talking about a variety of issues. Dave, just very briefly, the law that's going through right now that I think is virtually certain to pass, even if Obama vetoes, which he promised he would, but the vote in House and Senate was so overwhelming to pass this pure draconian police state law where, you know, the Marines can show up in the middle of the night, haul you away to a military dungeon, uncharged, and leave you there for the rest of your life. That's literally what this law is. But on October 17th, 2006, the same day the Military Commissions Act passed, and that had a nickname called the Torture Authorization Act. A lot more about it that is pretty hideous. But the idea of trying people in military commissions, no rights, no due process, no judicial fairness, no right of appeal, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Even the death penalty, what they give you is what you get, and that's the end of it, case closed. But on that same day, there was another provision passed in the 2007 National Defense Authorization Act, and the provision was basically the same thing as what's going through the House and Senate now. The effective annulment of posse comitatus around 1878, whenever it was, and America has had an Insurrection Act, 1807 Insurrection Act. Well, the provision that passed in 2006 abrogated both bills. In other words, the military up to that point, at least in theory, could not come out on U.S. streets except unless expressly authorized by Congress or during times of a national insurrection. Then the military could come out. Well, the military comes out anyway. My God, National Guard, Kent State back in the early 1970s. That's the military. Whether it's National Guard, whether it's the Marines, it's the military. So they came out then and they killed people. It's going to be institutionalized right out in the open where they can do it. And this is what we face.
Well, the other thing with the National Guard, they always try to claim that it's a militia, you know, and they come out on orders of the state governor, we had federal troops ordered out for the Little Rock incident by Eisenhower, I think, too. Because they couldn't trust the National Guard.
not down south, for sure.
So there is a history of this, but there was a strict legal procedure for doing it, for federalizing troops and stuff. And you had a call up of the National Guard by governors, which could then be challenged because it was at least a state thing. Now what really is upsetting about these, if you care about democracy and freedom, is that is this national aspect to it all. And as you said, the paramilitary form that and weaponry that's adopted by our police force, they look like what I saw when I was in China in police. You know, they're soldiers, they're not cops. And now you see that. I mean, it's pretty hard to tell whether a cop is a soldier or a cop during these protest actions by the police. They look like, you know, stormtroopers or troops, in Afghanistan. They're heavily armed. They're heavily armored. they're using weapons like grenades, and they're carrying assault rifles. You know, this is just totally inappropriate for policing. And then you have, as you say, you know, the end of Posse Comitatus, so we're going to have military doing doing riot patrol. We're not far away from massive roundups, again, as were envisioned under the Nixon administration. So it's a pretty grim picture now. And the stunning thing is how little the average American either knows or cares about this stuff. I mean, one of the great things that these courageous kids have been doing in Occupy is to put in front of people's faces what this looks like, what a police state looks like. And I think that has woken a lot of people up. It's, you know, the media has been forced to show it, and I think it's turned a lot of people's stomachs to see what's happening. But whether that will coalesce into a genuine resistance to it, I don't know.
Of course, the coverage giving people a view of what's going on, Dave, can be shut off very, very fast. There was more coverage early on. I don't watch television, so I don't know what they're showing.
I don't either.
they may have cut it off now. If there's something dramatic, they may cover it. But otherwise, they simply might not report what's going on. But as long as these protests come out, you're going to see arrests made. You're going to see police violence. And I don't see any let up on this. If anything, I see it getting worse, and it's very ugly stuff. And at the same time, we have a choice, Dave. We can either fight this thing, despite all of the abuse people will take doing it, or we can sit back and let the powers that be put into place the policies that they want and see us just descend further down, and we're heading for the worst of all possible worlds, economically, politically, militarily. I mean, we really have a wretched system going now. We have imperial wars. We have crackdowns at home. We have police state laws on the books. They keep adding more. And I think they're adding this newest provision, Dave, is it may be directly because of Occupy Wall Street, but they know that the economy is in the tank. Things are getting worse. I keep writing about the economy. I wrote an article this morning that'll go out on Monday on the Eurozone economy. But what happens over there affects us, if not right away, eventually. So the economy, the policies are making the economy worse, not better. Eventually, the pain level will keep rising. It rose high enough, Dave, to get Occupy Wall Street people out on the streets. If people weren't in pain, they wouldn't be out there doing this, let alone spread it across the country, ratchet up the effort, more people get involved. I mean, people are really suffering. Job losses, benefit losses, all kinds of hardships inflicted on people, and they're reacting, and the pain will get worse. So the protests will probably pick up in intensity. And I think these people want to be ready with brutal laws on the books to do pretty much what they want.
Well, let me offer two bright spots for you on this. I mean, one is a sort of a grim bright spot, but it's that I think that the United States is losing its power and sinking into, you know, second rate and maybe even third rate status as a nation. And so from the perspective of the world, I think there's hope that the United States, which is the greatest threat to peace and the greatest terrorist nation that the world has known, is losing its power. And so it can't win its wars. It's being threatened for supremacy, even militarily, by China. Russia's standing up. You know, I'm not saying those are great countries, but it provides, as Russia did once, balance against the abuses that the United States has exhibited. So you know, there is that we're sort of Rome in its death throes now, you know, saddled by debt, overburdened by our military extreme actions, and you know, so eventually this shall pass, and it will be us who pass. So I see that as a good thing, given that we can't seem to get rid of our obsession with militarism. But the other thing is that, and this I think is another optimistic vision, is that my generation, I'm 62, is just approaching large numbers of people starting to hit retirement and depend on Social Security and Medicare, which they're trying to destroy before we get there. My thesis is that, and I'm working on a proposal for a book on this myself, which I hope to be my next one, is that when the reason they're working so assiduously, the corporate powers, to get Congress and the president to gut Social Security and destroy Medicare, is that they realize once my generation is really in large numbers depending on those two programs, they will be untouchable, because we will be a senior lobby 50% larger than the one that exists today. And not only that, but the generation that's currently in retirement is relatively quiescent, you know, grew up in the 50s and, you know, is used to taking it on the, you know, quietly. But my generation is not. And we come out of that 60s era when we stood up against war. We stood up for civil rights, for minorities. We knew street politics. We also knew electoral politics with the, you know, McCarthy campaign and the McGovern campaign and so on. And we've just sort of ourselves gone into, you know, raising our families and, you know, advancing our careers and stuff. But now it becomes personal interest again, much like the draft was when they started attacking our retirement. And which, of course, is all we have, because they already screwed our savings and our property values that we were depending on have tanked. So it's really, we're left with Social Security and Medicare, and they're going to try to take those away. I think they're going to create a revolutionary situation all over again when my generation really wakes up to what's being done to us. And at that point, you know, all bets are off, because I think that we will be smart enough not to allow them to divide and conquer and say, okay, you guys can have your Social Security, but nobody else is going to get it. I think we realize how, you know, short-sighted it would be to go along with that kind of idea. And I also think that, you know, after all, it's our kids they're taking it away from. And then, you know, I also think we'll be smart enough to see that the way to save Medicare is to expand it to cover everybody and get the Canadian plan. So for both reasons, I think that there's a potential for my generation to, within a couple of years, open up a whole new front that could become the core of a new progressive movement for all ages.
Boy, I
so
sure
how's
hope
that
so.
For optimistic?
Well, I agree with everything that you said. I'm in the decade ahead of you, Dave, a decade older, and this old guy is anything but quiescent. That's for sure.
But, didn't mean to libel you all by guilt by association.
Well, in my first book, I have a chapter on the chopping block, and I'm talking about the plan is to get rid of Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, and public pensions as well. Basically, the plan is to get rid of everything that they can to free up as much money for the corporate interests, mainly bankers, and to fight imperial wars. That's what they want the money for. And,
that's right.
And people are going to get hammered more and more. They're going to lose more and more benefits. I mean, the deal that I got when I began working, Dave, well, 1960, Social Security, well, they raised the amount I had to contribute on that. I was a part of Medicare from day one, and both of these are insurance programs. But that's not the way the plans have been implemented. The deal for me as an insurance premium payer was I pay my premiums during my working life and I would get free medical care on retirement. Well,
right.
Free my foot. I have to pay Medicare Part B if I want to have it, and the plan simply doesn't cover enough. So I need a supplemental insurance plan, and you put the two of them together, and it costs me a lot of money to get my free Medicare.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's gonna cost more ahead, and I mean, they just want to get rid of it. They do it incrementally, as we know. I mean, Obama already has lopped off hundreds of billions of dollars, and the plan now is to lop off hundreds of billions more until there are no more hundreds of billions to lop off. They simply want to get rid of the program, and harm the people. Well, if anybody who can afford medical coverage, which is pretty tough. I mean, it's going to be tough enough for them to get to the coverage and be able to afford it as the costs keep going up. But what about people who are marginal earners and they simply can't afford it? They're going to get by with either bare bones medical care or maybe none at all. And it's a very ugly system that's coming down the road. I see the pain level rising in people, and I see the anger intensifying, And these are the sparks, Dave. I mean, you said it. These are the sparks that revolutions make. If that pain level gets severe enough and there's no remediation coming, there's just more hammering on people, making a bad situation worse, there's no telling what can happen. There's been a lot of revolutions in world history, and we sort of had one way back when. That was really different. We just may be heading for the real thing.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I'm you know, while Americans have been bought off with all this entertainment and with, you know, improved living standards for several decades, they've lost the ability or even the desire to do that now. And I think that, you know, the quiescence of Americans and the patience of Americans to endure this kind of garbage is going to end, and we're going to see the middle class in the streets at some point, probably not too far off.
Well, by the time they get there, Dave, the middle class will be the lower class.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's why they'll be there. But I mean, mental, you know, in terms of their cultural and political approaches, they have to overcome this inertia that's been built in and this, you know, mythical belief in voting once every 2 years to claim you have a democracy. It takes some time to undo, but I think it's being undone. The cynicism of Americans towards the political system is at a level that it's never been before. And it's one step away from saying to hell with it and, you know, turning to other methods. So I think we're going to see it happen.
Boy, I want to see it happen. I simply can't wait until something really bursts. I vividly remember the 1960s and the civil rights struggles, but that was basically one issue. Civil rights, a big issue, but one issue. Now we're talking about the whole enchilada now. We're talking about people, unemployed people, suffering people. I mean, really, really people being harmed politically, economically, socially. I mean, people are being harmed in multiple ways, and that's why many more people, it's not an issue that affected black people that died the civil rights. This is an issue hurting mass America. This is cutting right across the national spectrum, and ordinary people that used to be middle-class folks, they're losing their good jobs. If they're lucky, they get a poor one to replace it. They're losing benefits. I mean, I'm waiting for this thing to simply explode. I think they're doing
everything right to make it explode. You know, that's the amazing thing. They really are doing everything to make it blow up. And I think, you know, I mean, if history has any merit at all and predictability, I think we're going to see what we would see in any other society when you push people to the limit. It will, something will make it blow. And, you know, none of us expected Occupy. You know, we were all decrying the complete apolitical nature of American students and youth, and look at what they've done in a very short time. It's astonishing. So I think things can change in an instant, and so look for it.
Well, it certainly has worked out that way. And like you, Dave, I'm truly astonished that the Occupy movement really got traction very fast and spread virtually everywhere across the country. So we've got it across Europe. We've got it across here in the U.S. And because that happened, anything can happen to get enough people out. Protesting issues that hit them where it hits hottest. The pocketbook is usually the one that hits the hottest, and there are a lot of pocketbook issues now, and they're not getting better. In my article, it'll go out tomorrow, I'm talking about Europe, but I say Europe is really getting hammered, and the policies being instituted are making a bad situation worse. But anything crushing Eurozone countries is they're coming across the Atlantic, and they'll hit here just as hard. They spread globally. Europe is the single largest world economy all put together, about 20% of world GDP, and mm-hmm. and they consume an inordinate amount of world resources. And if Europe gets in trouble, and it's in big trouble now, that trouble is heading everywhere. And the pain level here in America will just get greater, and the anger will get greater. It's going to be nasty. It's already nasty, Dave, and it's going to get worse. And I've been wondering for so long, when will this really happen? Well, it hadn't until recently, since mid-September, and now it has, and there's no telling how far this can go.
Yeah, I think, you know, the spring is going to be an interesting time because, you know, the winter does put a damper on a lot of this for very good reasons. It's pretty cold out there in a tent on Granite Plaza. But, you know, I think that there's the potential for a real giant movement to arise in the spring. You know, the occupation people are calling for a gathering on the National Mall in April. They want to assemble a new, basically, alternative government, the way they talk about it, to lay out a new constitution. I mean, it's a really bold approach, and who knows how that'll be reacted to.
Well, I'd love to see that. I'm reminded about what happened in Venezuela after Hugo Chavez was elected. A new constitution was drafted in two phases, two referenda. Number one, do you want a new constitution? And when it passed overwhelmingly, the constitution drafted put to a vote. It was an extraordinary document, and it passed overwhelmingly as well. Just imagine if we could use national referenda to handle important policies of this country. I mean, this stuff is so important that it should go to the public. We are just about out of time, Dave. Let me give you a last comment, and the hour goes by much too fast.
Well, I think the thing I look for now is if we do have this national gathering in Washington, I hope we have a lot of angry veterans down there to stand around the edges and keep it safe from the Washington police and the National Guard that'll inevitably get called up.
Well, absolutely. By the way, if you hadn't discovered it yet, there's a group called Occupy Writers. Have you found that one?
No.
Oh, just Google Occupy Writers. I discovered it, and I joined, and they listed me as the author of How Wall Street Fleeces America. So I'm a member of Occupy Writers, and Dave...
Oh, I'm going to join right after this.
I am... You will absolutely be very welcome in that group. It's got a bunch of people in it. I thought it was marvelous. There's an Occupy Marines. There's an Occupy Police. A lot of different segments of society getting involved in this. We are plumb out of time, Dave. I look forward to getting you back again.
Thanks for having me. Send me a copy of your book and I'll review it.
Oh, I will send you a copy of the book. Absolutely. I'll tell my editor to send you a copy.
Terrific.
Do me a favor. You have my email address. Send me your mailing address.
You got it.
Okay. And I'll get your review copy. Join us
Bye-bye.
Again next week. Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.